Hi, I'm Francesca, a registered nutritional therapist, and you're listening to another episode of the Empowered Perimenopause podcast. Welcome. My aim is to bring you down-to-earth, conversational episodes that help you develop a deeper understanding of how your body's changing in your 40s, and most importantly, how you can support yourself throughout this wonderful transitional phase of your life. Join me for my solo episodes and also episodes with guests for fun, fresh, truthful chat on all things health and happiness in your 40s. And now onto the episode. Hi, and welcome to another episode of the Empowered Perimenopause podcast with me, your host, Francesca. So at the time of recording this episode, it is actually New Year's Eve. So I'm wishing you a very happy New Year in advance of tomorrow if you're listening to this on New Year's Eve. And of course, if you're already in 2025 listening to this, then happy New Year. Welcome to this brand new year. And I really hope it's something really special for you, for me, for all of us. So what inspired the content of today's episode is the fact that we are moving into a new year. And some of us may be looking for some really simple principles to really support their health and well-being as they move through 2025, as they move through perimenopause, and or just for kind of resetting yourself, getting back to health, really saying, right, this is a time now I'm going to focus on myself. It's a shame that it can take the new year for some of us to feel that way about, you know, resetting our health, but it is just human nature. So some of us might have had quite a stressful lead up to Christmas. And then that sort of routine disruption over the Christmas period can just leave us feeling pretty rubbish, particularly between Christmas and New Year. And then when it gets to New Year's Day, we're sort of like, right, I'm over this now. We just need a fresh start. So this might just be a nice way to reset your health and support your health and well-being as we move into 2025. So I wanted to talk through some of my key basic principles for generally supporting health and well-being and supporting a woman. For example, when my clients come to me one-to-one, the sort of things that I'll be looking at and what I call the low-hanging fruit that we get started with, because we really do need to address these key basic principles if we want to get some traction. So that's what I wanted to go through with you today. So I will kick off with the first thing that I'm always going to be looking at with all of my clients and myself, and what I suggest you to be looking at, is checking on levels of some of our key nutrients for health. So as we move past 40, it's a time when it's really important to start checking for any potential deficiencies in some of the key nutrients like iron, checking ferritin, B12, folate, and vitamin D. So these are easy to test for, and they're also easy to address if they're found to be not at optimal levels. And deficiencies in some or all of these nutrients, they can mimic a lot of the typical symptoms of perimenopause. So for example, low iron, low B12 would result in things like low energy, fatigue, low mood, anxiety, muscle aches and pains, heavy periods, headaches, more PMS. So this is what I call low hanging fruit. It's the first place to start when I work with people one-to-one. For that reason, I'm always saying, do you have any recent blood work you can share with me? If not, let's get some and really check on iron, B12, folate, vitamin D. Not only for symptom management, but if these are left unaddressed as well, deficiencies in any of these nutrients not found, it can start to over time spiral into more sinister health issues later on. So we don't just want to have, you know, be in perimenopause and have these symptoms of low energy, fatigue, this anxiety, which we do know is associated with the change in hormones of estrogen and progesterone in perimenopause, which I've discussed on loads of previous episodes and will continue to do so. But we don't just want to chalk up all of these sort of symptoms to perimenopause. We also want to know, well, can any of these be due to nutrient deficiencies? Can any of them be due to, for example, low thyroid function, which is the next thing I would suggest doing and plan to do it at least once a year? And that is, again, because a lot of the symptoms, as I just mentioned, for the other nutrient deficiencies can of an underactive thyroid can mimic those of perimenopause. So low mood, depression, weight gain, sleep issues, low energy, heavy periods. These can all mimic, you know, these can all be symptoms of underactive thyroid. And we can, again, just quite easily chalk them up to, oh, well, I'm in perimenopause. But again, let's look, is there anything else underlying these symptoms that we can address and tick the box on that and then improve these symptoms for you? So unfortunately, the two markers that are standardly tested by your GP, which are TSH, thyroid stimulating hormone, and T4, they're just not giving us enough information. Of course, they can be helpful, but it's not enough information. It's not the full picture for somebody to be able to happily walk away and say, oh yeah, they're fine. When it comes to thyroid health, what you want to know is, number one, is your thyroid gland making T4? So that is the thyroid hormone. Is it making enough T4? So great to check T4, of course. But we also want to know how much free T4 that you make as well. So you've got total T4, can be shortened to TT4, and we've got free T4, which can be shortened to FT4. You might see it like that on the test results. Conventional testing usually only looks at total T4. Some panels I have seen look at free T4, but usually it's just total. Total is the total amount that we make from the thyroid gland. The free levels of T4 is the amount of that total T4 that's actually available for your body to have, and it's not bound up elsewhere. Then we want to know, of that T4, how much of it is being converted into T3. Is a thyroid hormone not actually produced by the thyroid gland in big amounts, but mostly converted from T4 into T3. And this conversion happens within the tissues of the body that have got high blood flow. So for example, in the liver, in the kidneys. And T3 is the active or usable form of T4. So it's all very well having T4, but if that T4 isn't being converted into good levels of T3, we might feel pretty rubbish. Typical symptoms of underactive thyroid. This is why just looking at T4 isn't good enough. So if somebody says, if your doctor says, oh, your T4 is fine, yet you're sitting there with all of these underactive thyroid symptoms, you're left completely confused, frustrated, and you're never actually addressing the real cause of those symptoms, which is the fact that your T4 is not being converted into T3. So that's why we also want the T3 number as well. Then we also want to know, is there any autoimmunity occurring against your thyroid gland? So this requires testing for the two main thyroid antibody markers, which are thyroid peroxidase antibodies, also known as TPO antibodies, and thyroglobulin antibodies, also known as TG antibodies. So these antibodies cause damage to your thyroid gland, and one or both of them can be raised, but it's important that we're checking both of them. Even if just one of them is raised, that would suggest there is an autoimmune process going on against your thyroid gland. Thyroid autoimmunity is called Hashimoto's disease. It's an autoimmune condition, just like any other autoimmune condition. It just so happens to be against your thyroid. Whereas rheumatoid arthritis, for example, is autoimmunity against your joints. So it's all part of the autoimmune picture. It's different from person to person where that is presenting in their body. So what Hashimoto's disease or thyroid autoimmunity can create is a picture of subclinical underactive thyroid, meaning that it's not quite yet full-blown hypothyroidism, but it can look like it's going that way. So this picture could be that TSH would be slightly raised and T4, free T4 would be slightly reduced. And then eventually this can, you know, as these antibodies continue to break down the thyroid gland more and more over time, the situation would then turn into full-blown underactive thyroid, where TSH would be now quite elevated and free T4 quite reduced. Also, you would find that free T3 levels would also be low as well on a test. So this would look to a potential clinician that this is just a situation of hypothyroidism. So they may just say, right, we're going to give you thyroxine. So you would take that as a treatment here. But essentially, if you're not finding out that there's actually autoimmunity going on against your thyroid gland and you've got these raised antibodies, that is a huge part of the puzzle to miss, because that's the root cause of your hypothyroidism, not just simply the fact that you're not making enough T4. You're not making enough T4 because of the thyroid antibodies attacking your thyroid gland. So that is the root cause. That's where we want to look. That's why it's just really important that we do test for these as well. And doctors are likely to treat Hashimoto's disease with levothyroxine, the T4 replacement, in an attempt to maintain normal thyroid function. But again, as I said, this doesn't address the root cause. We do want to get into the root cause of why there is an autoimmune process going on, essentially a disease process going on in the body. And functional medicines and nutrition and lifestyle interventions can play a huge role in helping to manage an autoimmune disease process. So I'll do a whole separate episode on that, but for today, I'll leave it there. So checking key nutrients, checking thyroid health, Then increasing protein, so, so important. I've talked about this so much in the past and I will always continue to talk about it. So hopefully for some of you, if you've been listening to my episodes already, this will just be a reminder. So really want to be keeping our optimal protein levels consistent. This is a big one. If this is the only thing that you'll focus on this new year, this is going to take you quite far if you're not already getting optimal levels of protein. So aim to get a minimum of 30 grams of protein with your breakfast if you're not already doing that. And what I would say as well, aside from protein, is don't wait too long to eat your breakfast after waking. So I speak to so many women that say they don't eat their breakfast until 11 o'clock or 12 o'clock. They're trying to do this kind of intermittent fasting, but it really can be quite detrimental to us women in our 40s as we're moving through perimenopause. We're already in a state where our hormones are creating a situation where our cortisol levels are naturally too, you know, raising too high. We might have other stresses going on as well. And if we add to that the stress of going far too long without actually putting that dose of protein in the morning, that can really just put more and more pressure on our stress response system. So essentially the adrenal glands, two tiny little glands that are responsible for releasing our stress hormones in response to something like low blood sugar, which would occur after waiting too long for, for eating. Yes, ensure a 12-hour overnight fast, which can also be 13 or 14 hours. And essentially that fast would be from finishing dinner the night before and then starting breakfast the next day. So minimum 12-hour fast, always make that like just a non-negotiable rule. You can push that to 13 or 14 hours. But actually what I find and what a lot of other clinicians have found in their practice as well, and also with myself, pushing it past 14 hours can become quite detrimental to our health and our waistline and our mood and our sleep. So that's one thing I would definitely say, get that 30 gram protein dose in, within sort of 13, 14 hours of finishing dinner the night before. And, you know, you might need to start considering the sort of dinner for breakfast options if, you know, in order to get your 30 grams in. But it can take time to sort of change your mindset over from the typical sweet based breakfast, you know, the cereal, the porridge, the toast, and the two eggs, which is great, but two eggs is only 10 grams of protein. So what else can you get in at your breakfast to bring that up to 30 grams? So for me, it looks like chicken of any sort, chicken breast, chicken thighs, leftover dinner. This morning I had leftover lamb curry with kale for breakfast. Other mornings I have scrambled eggs with a good amount of smoked salmon to bring it up to 30 grams in total. Ideally, we want to be having 30 to 50 grams of protein. I'm just saying a minimum of 30. So 30 to 50 grams with all three meals, which would look like about 90 to 150 grams, depending on how much you get. And that is ideal. So I wouldn't want anyone to be having less than sort of 100 grams of protein a day split across their meals. Because past 40 and in perimenopause, the minimum levels of protein just isn't good enough anymore. You know, the two eggs for breakfast, getting your 10 grams of protein, it's just not good enough. Our body really does need that minimum 30 gram dose with every meal in order to stimulate something called muscle protein synthesis, which I have talked about in previous episodes. The research has found we need a minimum of 30 grams of pure protein, so preferably from animal sources, in order to, at least complete sources of protein to stimulate that building of muscle. Also just very, very helpful for blood sugar balance and preventing insulin resistance. So it might sound like a lot at first if you haven't heard this before, but once you get your head around it and you start to make it a habit for life, I can promise you that it becomes really easy, second nature, and that you will feel amazing for doing it. So I can promise you that you'll feel great for it. Then walking every day. Did you know, actually, that the 10,000 steps a day recommendation actually originated from a marketing strategy for a pedometer in the 60s in Japan, rather than scientific research? I never knew that. I always just thought I assumed the 10,000 steps a day came from some kind of scientific research that found that to be the magic number. But no, it literally came from a marketing strategy. It was sort of plucked out of thin air. Because it was catchy, 10K steps, it was catchy and it was appealing for the branding. Actually, scientific studies have shown mixed findings about how many steps we actually need. Research definitely shows that walking each day can significantly improve our health. And recent studies have shown that around 7 to 8,000 steps a day can offer significant health benefits. And for older adults, even lower step counts of 4 to 5,000 can still be beneficial compared to being sedentary. So rather than fixate too much on the step count, just aim to get outside every day to walk, preferably more than once, scattered out, throughout the day, to sort of break up periods of being sedentary, of sitting down. And can you make walking through nature a daily thing as well? Some sort of nature space, a park, a common, whatever it is you might be able to find locally where you can actually get, or, you know, on your commute, if you can take detours, any time at all, just spent in nature can be really beneficial, because there's so much research now on the power of being in some sort of green space for reducing stress and supporting mood, energy, and sleep. So big ones there, walk every day, get into nature. Lift weights at least twice a week. Research shows that 2 20- to 40-minute weightlifting workouts a week is enough to support strength and build muscle. So hopefully that sounds quite achievable for most of you if you're not already doing this. If you could do 3 of those sessions a week, great. If you're just doing 2, that's great too, because the research shows that can be adequate. Just aim to cover all of the big muscle groups each time you work out. So for example, legs, chest, back, shoulders, biceps, triceps, core. So there may be, you may be able to get some help in putting a program together if you're not already doing something like this. It's so important that we get our muscles moving, but that we also get them challenged with heavy weights. So this is heavy relative to you. I've done an episode on this in the past. I've got the Pillar 4 explanation episode on exercise and movement in your 40s. I've got the episode on muscle, the importance of muscle. So go back and listen to those. But very important, yes, that we're challenging our muscles at least twice a week for 20 to 40 minutes to help us build muscle and maintain it as we're losing muscle as we move through perimenopause. Look after your nervous system. So the nervous system is like the body's communication network. I've done episodes on this in the past. It's made up of the brain, the spinal cord, and a huge web of nerves that run throughout your body. We can also call it it's also known as the autonomic nervous system. And it has 2 main parts: the sympathetic nervous system, often referred to as the fight or flight system, which prepares your body for action and stress. And then we've got the parasympathetic branch of the autonomic nervous system. This is known as the rest and digest part of our nervous system, and it helps our body to relax and conserve energy. And we need equal time, basically, in both of these. You know, we do need some time in fight or flight. Of course we do, sympathetic. But we also need a good amount of time in our parasympathetic, rest and digest. Most of us spend pretty much all of our time, unless we're asleep, in our fight or flight system. So in short, we want to balance this out. Your nervous system keeps your body running smoothly in the background, and we should never underestimate, and we must always remember the importance of supporting it, because central to all the health issues, the symptoms, the challenges associated with hormone changes in perimenopause and loss of those hormones at menopause is the nervous system. A dysregulated autonomic nervous system will cause and exacerbate an ongoing cycle of all the various symptoms that we struggle with in perimenopause: low energy and fatigue, low mood and anxiety, sleep issues, pain, so muscles, joints, systemic pain, low immunity, bloating and distension in the gut and other gut and digestive issues, also low stomach acid, low digestive enzymes to help us break down our food, resulting in more gastrointestinal symptoms, but also in malabsorption of nutrients from your foods, basically. The autonomic nervous system basically touches every system in the body. No menopause supplement, probiotic or antihistamine or paleo diet or other food plan or even hormone therapy is going to resolve these symptoms and issues if your nervous system is dysregulated. It's so, so important. Nervous system care and support to help you regulate it, so, you know, balance out our parasympathetic and sympathetic nervous system states, is so important now more than ever. And it should be from now on. It doesn't have to be anything fancy or out of reach. In fact, it really isn't. Daily time in nature, like I just mentioned, healthy movement, daylight exposure upon waking. So first thing in the morning, within 20, 30 minutes of waking, getting into daylight, or using a 10,000 lux light box in these winter months, which is what I use. Having an evening wind down routine, dimming the lights in the hours before bed, having an hour before you get into bed where you're not looking at your screens and your WhatsApp and your TVs. Express gratitude, thinking or writing down things that you're grateful for, things that are amazing about your life, because there really are lots of things. Writing your thoughts down, brain dumping, relaxing with your pets, relaxing with your loved ones. These are some of the key ways you can regulate your nervous system. Also humming, singing. When I said healthy movement, things like yoga, qigong, tai chi, these are lovely ways to support your nervous system. And nothing as well is so, so helpful is walking in nature. For me, walking in nature changes everything. I can feel a really horrible sort of sense of dread or anxiety. And when I step outside and actually go into my local common, which I am lucky enough to have basically on my doorstep, as soon as I get in there and I'm faced with all this beautiful nature, I suddenly just feel this sense of relief and calm wash over me. So anything that gives you that sense of relief and calm washing over you, and of all the things I've just mentioned there, hopefully a good few of those can do that for you. So get more of those into your day, not just into your week, into your days throughout the week. And then also helpful is to reduce your exposure to hormone mimicking or hormone disrupting chemicals. So these are the various chemicals in our modern environment that we find in our products and, you know, plastics and things that have been shown to take the place of real estrogen inside our cells and cause havoc in the hormone or endocrine system of the body. They can be really problematic. They also add to the total load of estrogen in the body and drive things like fibroid growth, heavy periods, breast pain, and even some estrogen-related cancers. It refers, the term hormone-disrupting chemicals refers to a whole list of chemicals such as, you know, BPA. So you've probably heard of BPA-free plastics, for example, but there's a whole load of different ones. And phthalates, parabens, all these different, there's a whole load of different chemicals that are predominantly found in plastics, skin and hair care products, body care products, household cleaning products, detergents, perfumes, sprays, plug-ins, candles, air fresheners, anything with sort of synthetic perfume as well will likely have these chemicals in them. Essentially, reducing your intake of these chemicals can make a profound difference to symptoms that I just mentioned, heavy painful periods, mood issues, headaches, because these chemicals impact your liver's ability to break down your own, to clear out and break down your own used estrogen, and then add, as I said, to the body's total load of estrogen, and not in a good way. So someone might think, oh, but isn't that good if I've got low estrogen? No, it's not good, because they're not the real thing. So switching to a chemical-free or sort of cleaner brands, for example, for your skincare, for your household cleaning products, for your fragrances, is a big recommendation of mine. And I will do a separate episode on all of this soon. So some brands that I like for cleaner skincare, for example, include Sukin, S-U-K-I-N, Green People, Tropic Skincare, Ren, Faith in Nature. They do pretty clean stuff as well. Some of it's because there's more and more cleaner brands coming out now, the prices are becoming more competitive. So that's good, because sort of 10 years ago when I started looking into this, they were very expensive. So the prices are starting to come down now, which is great. But you can literally just Google chemical-free skincare, chemical-free household cleaning products, and you'll find a whole list of different brands that you can have a look at. I like Method for household cleaning, and Bio-D as well is another brand. And then we can also try supportive supplements. So supplements that can support our mood, our anxiety, our sleep include magnesium, specifically in the glycinate form, glycine, taurine, and ashwagandha. So ashwagandha is what we call an adaptogenic herb that can support the nervous system, essentially, and can support us adapting between the two different nervous system responses. And other adaptogenic herbs can also help. So ashwagandha is just one of the most popular ones, but there's lots of different supportive adaptogenic herbs as well. And in fact, having a blend rather than just one type can actually work better than just having ashwagandha alone, for example. So things like holy basil, rhodiola, relora, gosh, there's a whole list. So I'll do a separate episode on that as well. In fact, if you go back to my cortisol episode called, I can't remember what number it is, but I think it's called Why You're Stressed and Anxious in Perimenopause or in Your 40s, I actually go through a lot of the herbs in that episode. B vitamins as well, also really important. And of course, vitamin D. But test your levels for like B12, folate, and vitamin D to then see how much you need to be taking of those nutrients. But all of the other B vitamins as well are important. So good quality B complex would probably be very helpful as well. So I hope these tips have been helpful. I hope there's something you can take away from today that will help support your health in 2025. And if you'd like my help on a one-to-one basis, then my practice is open and there for you. You can find the ways to work with me over on my website. So that's francescaliparotti.com. You can click on the services tab to see the ways you can work with me one-to-one. My health optimization roadmap is a great place to start. If you're not quite sure how much input you need from me, or you're not quite ready to take the 3-month support package, the roadmap is a great place to start. And from there, if you feel you do need continued support, you can simply upgrade from the roadmap to the 3-month package and just pay the difference. So any questions, let me know. My email address is going to be in the show notes. So that's it for today, and I'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
If you found this episode helpful, then please share it with anyone else who you think could benefit. And consider leaving a rating and a review, as this will help the podcast to reach and help more people. And if you need more guidance on your own health journey, you can grab my free guide, 6 Steps to Mastering Your Hormones in Your 40s, over at francescaliparotti.com, where you can sign up for your free copy. Or you'll also find the link in the show notes.